Next case for argument this morning is Sandage against the Board of Commissioners.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Fred Schultz, and I represent the plaintiff's decedents, Sheena Sandage Schaffner and Alfonso Small, in this matter against Vandenberg County. We are here, Your Honors, because before my clients were murdered by a work release inmate in the custody and control of the Vandenberg County Work Release Program, the very people who ended up being murdered by this gentleman.
The trouble I have with your argument is that it amounts to saying that any time a prisoner at jail releases on parole or at the conclusion of his sentence or what have you, someone who is dangerous, and that person then goes and commits a crime, the crime victims can sue the correctional authorities.
I disagree, Your Honor. We distinguish this case from the Supreme Court's decision in DeShaney or other such situations where the criminal actor is out in the public. In this particular instance, the criminal...
No, that's what I'm talking about, a situation where this person is incarcerated. He's in jail in a prison, and they decide to let him out. You know, his term is expired, or they decide, you know, they're too crowded, or some judge says, you know, you've got to reduce crowding in your jail. So they let a whole bunch of people out, some of whom they know are dangerous. Or they don't arrest them in the first place, a dangerous person, right? If this person had threatened these people and the police hadn't done anything about it, there wouldn't be any federal claim against them, right?
Correct, Your Honor, if he was out in the public at the time.
So what's the difference between out in the public or being on work release or being inside and breaking out? Or why should any of that make a difference?
Because in this situation, in the situation you're describing, the defendant or the county, the governmental entity, has custody and control of the person at that time.
There's no federal duty to retain custody of dangerous people.
Correct. Your Honor, but in this...
It's good that you think the judges are correct all the time. This is another trope of lawyers you may expect the judges find annoying.
I understand. Your Honor, in this situation, though, the county had custody control of the very instrumentality.
What difference does it make?
What difference does it make?
Suppose there's some mushy, you know, some 1950s Swedish socialists take over the jail and they say, the only way to rehabilitate prisoners is to let them out and you know, give them a nice home or something.
They
cause mayhem everywhere because it's a bad penological experiment.
Because at the time that the governmental entity has custody of the person, they also have control of the person. They're able to prevent
the
harm.
But they can release the person anytime they want.
You see, you emphasize that in your brief, and I don't understand how that begins to distinguish DeShaney. The social services people had perfect control of Joshua DeShaney. The problem was they gave Joshua back to his father. So your argument that DeShaney can be distinguished because once they had control and then they relinquished it is just a restatement of the facts of DeShaney.
But when they have control of the person, at the time they have control, they have the ability to, in this case, they have the ability to remove him from
work. They have the ability to hold on to Joshua DeShaney, too.
The child in DeShaney was released, and then several months later, once he was released back to his father, it was when the harm occurred.
Several months was not true.
Several months was irrelevant to the court's discussion. It could have been several minutes on the court's view. What has troubled me about this case is not simply that your distinction of DeShaney is just a restatement of the facts of DeShaney. It's that the Supreme Court has held in cases like Linda R.S. against Richard D. and Leek against Timmerman that no one in the United States has a right to have somebody else in jail. And you're asking us effectively to overrule the Supreme Court by creating a damages remedy on the ground that somebody else is not in jail. I don't see how we could reconcile that with Linda R.S. or Leek.
No, Your Honor. We're asserting that when they have the person, that they have an ongoing duty to...
They have to keep him, but...
What behaviors...
Do you think it would be a violation of the Constitution for this person to have been picked up and the prosecutor then chooses not to prosecute him?
No, Your Honor.
But then they had him and decided not to keep him.
Correct, but at this point he was serving a sentence. All of that had
but
been...
But I don't see why any of that is relevant to a federal claim. There may or may not be a state claim about whether the state has properly implemented its sentence, but that has nothing to do with federal law.
Your Honor, we look at this case as being similar to the situation in Monfils, where you had individuals who were out in the public, where you had an informant call and inform the police of criminal conduct at his workplace, and then the very person who was being investigated and charged for the crime made it very clear that he was going to do something to whomever it was, and the victim called the police and asked them, begged them essentially, not to release the tape. They did so anyways, and then the person ended up suffering a horrible death. The same is true in this case. You have a woman who repeatedly calls within a 30-day period. She called 30 days before her death, and she called just 2 days before her death. And she asks somebody at the jail who has custody of the person to do something.
You're not explaining why there is a constitutional difference between being picked up and let out and not picked up at all. If these calls had been made and the person had never been picked up, we know from Linda R.S. against Richard D. and Leek against Timmerman that your client would not be able to say that the rights were violated because the police didn't come and take these people away. I don't see why it makes a difference that they were first taken away and then let back. Right? We know from DeShaney that the fact that Joshua was taken away and then given back didn't make a difference.
Sure.
I can't see why, therefore, it makes a difference that somebody is picked up and then let out.
Because he was only being let out. This Travis Moore gentleman in the present case was only being let out on a condition of work release. He was continuing to serve a criminal conviction. He had a 4-year sentence. He was sentenced to jail. This is not a situation where they pick him up and release him. This is a situation where they pick him up. Yes, he has a privilege to go out into the public.
Getting anywhere, but I interrupted my colleague, Judge Rovner. I'm sorry I interrupted. Let me turn it back to you.
I wondered about your argument that the 12B6 dismissal was premature, and I wondered what facts do you think would come out on remand that would make your case more compelling?
The frustrating thing is we don't know what we don't know. I mean, we haven't taken depositions of the defendants yet. We haven't taken depositions of the Sergeant Mattingly who took the phone calls from the woman who ended up dead. I guess what we're asking this court to do is simply remand the case so that further proceedings can be done.
What would you be looking for? What would you hope to find?
Your Honor, what we anticipate is that we would be able to put people under oath. We would be able to confirm what conversations they had, when they had them.
What are you looking for? What do you hope to find in those conversations?
Taking the facts that we have in our complaint and extrapolating reasonable inferences, it's reasonable, we believe, to assume that Travis Moore, the very person who committed these murders, said, "I'm going to go get her," or he's going to tell an inmate, "I plan to knock her off," or how he got the gun, or all of these things that we still don't know.
How does the defendant's behavior here shock the conscience? Because that's what we would, need. Is there anything to suggest the possibility of a subjective culpable state of mind on the part of the county?
But, Your Honor, under a 14th Amendment due process violation, as the court knows, the plaintiff doesn't have to prove intent to harm. We have to prove something more than negligence less than intentional conduct, something in the terms of gross negligence or recklessness. And Your Honor, we would submit that when the defendant received two phone calls from the very same person asking for help from this particular inmate, I see my time is up. May I finish my... I'll never ask that question again.
It's not that books on appellate advocacy tell lawyers to ask that question. In fact, they tell lawyers not to ask that question.
Anyway, I know, but there are a lot of judges, and I can tell you from personal experience, who would say, thank you, Mrs. Rovner, in the middle of one of my brilliant arguments.
All right. You are now under a judicial order to answer Judge Rovner's question.
Your Honor, the very fact that what shocks the conscience and at least makes, we believe, the defendant obtusely unaware of a known danger is the very person who's calling, and there's agreement here, the very person who's calling asking for help from the very person who ends up killing her and her friend, who is in custody of the defendant, is essentially ignored. And we believe that does shock the conscience.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Vonderahe.
May it please the Court, Counsel Keith Vonderahe on behalf of the county defendants here today. In short, the county defendants believe that DeShaney controls this case, just as Judge Barker.
So how do you distinguish the case with the informant, and he asks not to reveal his name to his enemies, and they do, and so on?
In that case, there was a specific affirmative act. There was the release of the tape by the police to the person.
Where affirmative act gets you,
I'm sorry, Judge.
Well, I'm not sure what an affirmative act does.
Well, I think the affirmative act...
What's a negative act or a non-act?
Are you asking what is a negative act? I'm sorry, Judge.
Suppose the victims had asked the prison authorities not to release him, and they said, no, we're going to release him anyway. Would that be an affirmative act?
Under the case cited by the court and by counsel, I think it would be, but that is not what happened here. What happened here was...
So you'd agree that if they had refused a request to retain him, they then would have violated Section 1983?
Under the current holding of the case, I think that is what I would have to agree with, Judge. But that is not what happened.
Well, that's awfully strange concession, because then it's like saying if someone calls the police and says, I'm being threatened, and the police don't do anything, they're guilty of a constitutional violation. You're giving away a lot.
Judge, the case that you're referring to is the Monfils case. In the Monfils case, you had an employment setting. You had an employee call the police and say a fellow employee was going to steal some things from the company. And he made the call anonymously. Monfils then goes back to work. The employee, after having been arrested, tells a whole group of workers, I'm going to find out who made that call, and I'm going to kill him. And Monfils then calls the police again and says, do not release my tape. I don't want you to release my tape. In fact, goes to the police department on more than one occasion.
No, I understand. It's a more extreme case than this. But what's the analytical distinction between refusing a request and simply, ignoring the threat?
In the Monfils case, there were those two things. There was a request and a threat.
Why does it make a difference?
There's neither of those here, Judge.
Well, why does it make a difference whether that element is present or not?
Because without those elements, we don't have an affirmative act.
That's a conclusion. That's just words, affirmative act.
I would go...
What's some commonsensical reason for drawing the line between that case and this case?
The commonsensical line comes from DeShaney, where the state does not have a duty to protect private actors against violence from other private actors. And to get past that threshold holding from our Supreme Court, you then go to the state-created danger exception. And the first element under the King case, recently decided by this court, is there has to be an affirmative act that created or otherwise increased the danger to the defendant. And so here...
The only problem, of course, is that there was a, quote, affirmative act in DeShaney. The state social service worker gave Joshua DeShaney back to his father's custody. I don't understand why you're not saying that Monfils is incorrectly decided and should be overruled. You can then add that we don't have to overrule it for you to prevail, but accepting it as gospel and then trying to reconcile it just weakens your position.
I don't accept it as gospel because we have King that postdates Monfils, and King goes through the three-part analysis that was not in place in Monfils. And King says you have to meet all three parts, Judge. You have to meet the affirmative act.
I say the third part, this shock the conscience, I don't see what that is. In fact, I don't see what the second part is.
The second part seems if you don't have the first, you don't have the second. But,
what actions were taken in response to Sand and Schopner's complaints about Moore?
Judge, as you know, on a 12b-6, we're confined to the pleadings of the complaint is true, and if we believe those pleadings, no action was taken.
So no action was taken.
No action was taken. I also would direct the court to the pleadings, to the amended complaint, where the only allegation is that there were two phone calls. All that the amended complaint state is that phone calls and she was being harassed. Never that she was threatened. Never that Travis Moore said he was going to harm her. Never that Travis Moore said he was going to kill her. Never that Travis Moore went to her apartment or her place of work or otherwise disturbed her. Just that she had been harassed by him. I see my time.
Did the Sheriff's Department have any policy or practice for handling complaints about inmates on work release or, you know, other individuals under its supervision?
Judge, again, we're bound by the pleadings here. If Your Honor wants me to go on my common knowledge.
No.
Okay. Based on the pleadings, no, Your Honor.
No. And I take it based on the pleadings, we don't know where he got the gun.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
I take it that also based on the pleadings, we don't know where he got the gun.
We have no idea, Your Honor.
Gave him the gun when it let him out on work release.
We certainly do not, Judge.
At least that's not alleged.
Your Honors, if there's no further questions, I thank you for the court's time.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement. And our final case.